Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, Human Anatomy, and it's October 17th. We're going to start Nervous System today, which is Chapter 12. So you've been tested on everything so far, including up through Chapter 11, except a couple people still have a practicum today. And when those people are done with their practicum after lecture, then everybody will be done with 50% of the class, because we're halfway done. All right, so does anybody have any questions over the schedule? So today we said is what, the 17th? Indeed it is. All right, we have a disaster drill scheduled for tomorrow, and then Monday we're going to do central nervous system, Wednesday peripheral, then autonomic nervous system, some special senses, endocrine, and heart. Okay, the next exam will cover up through the endocrine system, but not the heart. Okay, so that's, and the next exam is November 14th. So it's still a little ways off. And then you'll be 75% done with the class. And on exam number 3, November 14th, there will not be a lab practicum. It will be the week before. So, and what else about exam number 3? It's on a Wednesday, not a Monday, because Monday that week is a holiday, Veterans Day, and nobody comes to school. So that's an extra day that you guys could go to work. Or better yet, what could you do? Maybe study for the exam. Yeah, okay. And I get to make the test up probably on that Monday. All right, so that's where we are in the schedule. And so we're going to start Chapter 12 today, which is Introduction to Nervous System. I'm going to turn the lights down in just a second after I pull up some slides. I do want to show you some slides. Ah, good, here are some slides. Excellent. Okay, and then I'll slide this over here. Make it big. Now, can you guys see these things? You can. Nice. And I'll turn some of these lights off, like these lights. All right, we're ready to go. Okay, so the nervous system, there are some basic divisions of the nervous system. So this first page that I have with a bunch of arrows on it is something that I want you to refer to through the next couple weeks. I want you to understand all the nervous system in terms of this overall diagram. So the nervous system is the master control and communication center of the body, and its main functions are these three things. It accepts sensory input, so it can experience things in our environment or internal environment. So it can measure things that are going on around us, like the temperature and the salt concentration and even blood pressure inside your body. And light, for instance. And what would you need in order to observe light? You need your eyes, right, which is an external sensor. And then that information enters the central nervous system with these sensory input neurons. And a sensory input neuron is an afferent neuron. An afferent neuron takes information from the periphery into the central nervous system, which we haven't defined yet, so I'll tell you what the central nervous system is. Central nervous system is made of the brain and the spinal cord. And probably you had an inkling of that because of the cranial and vertebral cavities contain the brain and spinal cord, which are the components of the central nervous system. All right, and the central nervous system is filled with association neurons, not afferent neurons. Afferent brings information into the CNS. Integration neurons make sense of it. Right, that allow you to perceive what's going on and then make a decision on what you should do with that information. And then those decisions are sent out back from the brain and spinal cord to effector organs, like muscle. Like if your eyes are seeing a big bus coming right at you, then the decision your brain, all those association neurons are going to make is to get out of the way. And the only way you can get out of the way is to send nerve impulses down to muscles, those pathways that take nerve impulses from the brain to muscle so that you can run out of the way of that bus are what we call efferent neurons or motor neurons, because they're motorizing your body so that you can get out of the way of the bus. So if we look at the slide on the right, we see that here is a stimulus, right? A stimulus, and this stimulus right here, what can you tell me about this modality of stimulus? What kind of stimulus is this right here? I can say if I have an ice cube in this beaker, that could be a little confusing. Okay, but there's no ice cube in this beaker, so we're not measuring temperature. What is your body measuring? Yeah, it's just a visual experience, right? So there's light coming from this object, and that's the stimulus, and we have eyes that can appreciate that stimulus. So the eyes pick up that light, convert it into electrical impulses, which then gets sent to the brain. How do electrical impulses get into the brain? Through a sensory neuron, all right? And another name for a sensory neuron I have over here, and we use these terms interchangeably, would be afferent. Afferent and sensory are exactly the same thing. And this arrow right here, is that a bidirectional arrow or just a single direction? Single direction, right? So sensory is only in one direction, in toward the central nervous system, which is the brain and spinal cord, from the periphery, and your eyeball for sure is in your peripheral part of your body, because only brain and spinal cord are centrally located. All right, once that nerve impulse gets into the central nervous system, including the spinal cord, which we barely see on this diagram, then this is an association neuron. And then the job of the association neuron is to integrate information up so that a brain can make a proper decision. All right, so in this particular case, we just see this glass of water, and a good decision would be, maybe I should drink that water. And if there's other information that's coming to this association neuron, like you're thirsty, then what? That even makes more sense, right? But now if you're seeing some other things, or maybe smelling something, maybe it smells bad. Now what is your decision going to be? Oh, I'm thirsty, I see a glass of water, but it smells bad. This association neuron is going to say, wow, I don't want to get sick. I better not drink that water. I'm going to wait for the next glass of water to come by, right? Okay, so that's the job of an association neuron. Or maybe this eyeball sees a bunch of bubbles coming out and sees that this water is boiling. So now the water smells good, it's safe to drink, okay, and you're thirsty, so you need water, but you see that it's boiling. What's the decision this association neuron is going to make? Oh, I better not drink it because I could burn my mouth, right? So that's the job of association neurons, to integrate all kinds of information up. And then when it makes a decision, it sends that decision out through a motor pathway. What's another name for a motor pathway? Efferent, all right, to a voluntary muscle, like a skeletal muscle, which then is going to obey the commands from the central nervous system. And skeletal muscle always obeys the commands. It never can make up its own mind, unlike some other kinds of muscle, like cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. You can tell smooth muscle to contract, or you can tell smooth muscle to relax when it is contracted, and your thoughts just can't control it. But skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. And as a matter of fact, that is the only organ that is under voluntary control. Everything else is controlled automatically in your body. So I see a stimulus, I see a receptor, I see an afferent neuron, association neuron, then an efferent neuron. An efferent neuron stimulates an effector organ, and that produces a response. So this first dotted line is a stimulus, and a stimulus always results in a response. Okay, so there are a couple of things maybe you could fill on in this nice picture right here. Okay, so effector is controlled by an efferent neuron. All right, so let's look at some of the, not such a functional discussion of the nervous system, but that's important for you to know, but more of a structural analysis of the nervous system, which we see with all of these arrows right here. All right, so the structural divisions. We have the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, and we abbreviate that CNS and PNS, and I will just refer to those acronyms throughout the rest of the class. So when I say PNS, you know I'm talking about peripheral nervous system. That is everything that is outside of the brain and spinal cord, because the brain and spinal cord are part of the CNS, right? So just be aware of that. There are electrical pathways that are made up of axons of dendrites that we call tracts. So information can be passed over long distances very rapidly via electrical impulses through things that we call tracts. And where do we find tracts? We find tracts in the central nervous system. All right, so these are major pathways for transmitting information. A nucleus, you know what a nucleus is because we looked at cells. A nucleus contains genetic material inside the cell, protects the DNA and chromosomes. right? But a nucleus in terms of neuroanatomy has a totally different meaning. It's a group of nerve cell bodies that are located in the central nervous system, and it is a special integration center that contains a lot of association neurons. So a nucleus is, and it looks different compared to other parts of the central nervous system. Tracts will look white, so you might want to just jot down white for tracts, and a nucleus will look gray. And we're going to see why that is in just a little bit. Hey, did I forget to put the sign-in sheet out? Is it going around? It's going around? Good. Okay, good. All right. Then the peripheral nervous system is, like I said, everything outside the brain and spinal cord. And we don't have tracts and nuclei in the peripheral nervous system, but we have structures that are fairly similar. Analogous to a tract in the central nervous system, in the PNS, is what we call a nerve. So you have these pathways that conduct electrical impulses through your periphery, but we don't call it a tract. By definition, we call it a nerve. The structure is a little bit different, and we'll observe what the difference in that structure is. But for sure, there's a big difference in location, because where do you find a tract? CNS. And where do you find a nerve? PNS. And can you ever find a nerve in the CNS? And the answer is no. Okay, because we have tracts. And what color are these tracts in the CNS? They're going to be white colored. Right. Okay. The counterpart of nuclei in the peripheral nervous system is what we call a ganglion. It's going to be a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and we're going to see what these things are today. All right, so I might come back and describe this. So those are the two basic subdivisions. If we were to take all nervous tissue and break it down into two main categories, those would be the main categories, CNS and PNS. And then the CNS we can further break down into brain and spinal cord. All right, so here is that nice flow diagram, the nervous system divisions. We said there are how many main divisions? Two, central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. So that's why we see two arrows here first. And then the central nervous system, furthermore, we could break down into brain and spinal cord. And these have tracts and nuclei. Peripheral nervous system, we need to analyze a little bit further. And we can break everything in the peripheral nervous system down into two major divisions. And I see it on this slide over here. So this blue neuron is one of the divisions, and I bet this is a nice another color like red or something down over here. Is that right? Okay, blue. That is what? The sensory division, and this red one, that is the motor division. What's another name for sensory? Afferent, and motor would be efferent, leaving the central nervous system, right? So we have sensory or afferent. This is when a sensory receptor sends information to the central nervous system. And the second one is motor or efferent. This is when signals are sent from the CNS back out to the periphery to an effector organ. We're going to classify some effector organs in just a second. All right, so the motor division we can break down into two divisions as well, because you have different kinds of effector organs. The first one is what we call somatic division, a somatic motor pathway. The second one is autonomic motor pathway. So these are going to go to effector organs. Somatic refers to skeletal muscle only. And under what kind of control is skeletal muscle? It's voluntary. It's under voluntary control. You control that with your mind. All right, so somatic motor pathway is from CNS to skeletal muscle. It's voluntary. And another name for somatic means body. Right, so your superficial body contains your skeleton and it contains muscle, are the main components. Inside your body cavities, those contain visceral organs. So the somatic part of your body is different than the visceral part. Right, somatic means more superficial, containing skeletal muscle, and visceral are deep organs, like your heart and lungs and digestive system. Right, your heart and digestive system you can't control voluntarily. That is involuntarily controlled by this division of the motor system, which is what? The autonomic nervous system controls all of your visceral organs or viscera. Furthermore, it's important for you to realize that the autonomic nervous system has, guess what, how many divisions? It's got two. I see two arrows right here, and you got to be familiar with these different divisions. One is called sympathetic, and the other is called parasympathetic. And these are almost 99% of the time antagonistic to each other. You can't say that sympathetic will always be excitatory and parasympathetic will be inhibitory, but if you know one, then just pick the opposite action, you know what the action is of the other. They're going to be antagonistic to each other. And then, does that seem like a beautiful thing to you or a terrible thing to you? Is that good or bad to have antagonism in a control system? How about your car? Yeah, because you never think of driving your car without both a gas pedal that makes it go and a brake pedal that makes it stop. Same thing for your autonomic nervous system. There's one part of the nervous system that makes your body go, and there's another part that keeps you from going, okay, or slows you down. And the parts of your body that respond to the autonomic nervous system are what we call effector organs. Here are the three kinds of effector organs in your body that are controlled autonomically. And if you want to say automatically, that's probably okay. That's not scientific, but that describes the autonomic nervous system pretty well. You have three effector organs. You have smooth muscle, which we find in the wall of hollow organs inside our body, like digestive system, reproductive system, urinary system. Okay, that's controlled by smooth muscle. Then we have cardiac muscle. Where would you find cardiac muscle? In the heart. And then glands, like sweat glands, salivary glands, and other kinds of glands in your skin, sebaceous glands, apocrine and eccrine sweat glands. Those things you can't control, but they're controlled automatically by the autonomic nervous system. All right, so this diagram I want you to refer to through the whole series of lectures on nervous system, just so that you have it nicely organized in your mind. All right, so here we see visceral effector organs. We said there are three: smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. All right, but there is also a somatic effector organ. What's the somatic effector organ? Hey, you guys, are you disturbing the class over there with your talking? Yeah, just keep it down a little bit or go outside. So what's a somatic effector organ? Somatic is skeletal muscle. All right, so we learned of four effector organs today. Three of them are visceral and one is somatic. The somatic one is skeletal muscle under voluntary control. And then the visceral ones are things you can't control: smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And you got to be able to rattle them off just like that. Just like you got to be able to rattle off what a sensory neuron is versus an efferent or motor neuron. Right. Okay. I don't know what's on my next slide. Let's see. Here's a nice designation that shows some of these different divisions. All right, in like a beige color to me, we have the brain and the spinal cord, which then makes up the CNS. All right, and then in these gold colors over here, all right, we see some nervous tissue. These are long fibers, right? Not in the brain or spinal cord, so that means they're in the peripheral nervous system, or PNS. Okay, how did I do with the colors? Good enough? Okay. In the peripheral nervous system, we have these nerves, which are pathways for electrical pathways, and then ganglia. Maybe you can see that this is kind of a little swelling right here. Can you see that's a little swollen area? There's a little ball. Here's a little bulge here and a little bulge here. That's a ganglion because it's a special group of cells that's performing a special function, and it's in this gold color, so that is the peripheral nervous system. A group of these cells in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglia. But if we were to open up the brain, we might see a group of things inside the brain that will look gray. We don't want to call that a ganglia. We want to call that a nucleus. Okay, so a nucleus and a ganglia are counterparts to each other in the central nervous system versus the peripheral nervous system. All right, so that's a pretty good slide. And I think I talked about all of this already. All right, but that's another nice synopsis. My diagram is a little bit simpler, but once you start to appreciate my diagram, then go to this one and study this one just a little bit more. Okay, so that takes us to nervous tissue. And you're familiar with tissue already. And I don't know, somebody should tell me something about nervous tissue with respect to other kinds of tissues. What do you know about tissues? How many major kinds of tissues are there in your body? Yeah, there's only four. There's only four kinds. What are those four kinds? Muscle is one. We got done talking about that one. That's specialized to contract. What's another one? Connective tissue, that connects different parts of your body together, including blood. It connects your brain to your heart and the lungs and all that stuff. So we got, muscle, connective tissue. What's another kind? Epithelium covers the surface, lines of cavity. And one more, because we said four, nervous tissue. Right, so that's what we're talking about now, nervous tissue. Nervous tissue is made up of two major kinds of cells. One is called a neuron, and the other is called a support cell, or a neuroglial cell, or neuroglia cell. And we're going to start by talking about neurons first. Neurons receive information and send electrical impulses. That's their basic function. And the neuroglial cells help the neurons do their job in one form or another. But let's first look at a neuron. So the human body contains billions of non-dividing neurons. So all the neurons that we have, the brain that we have right now, is pretty much all the nerve cells that we're ever going to have. They don't divide, at least as far as we know. Maybe we can trick the brain to do it. That doesn't mean your brain doesn't grow. It does grow all the time. When you learn new information, new connections are made between cells. The number of cells doesn't change, but the interconnection between cells changes. Right, so the structure of your brain does change by making new connections with other cells. And that's one way that we can understand a learning process. So when you take a rigorous class like a physiology or micro, an anatomy class, guess what happens to your brain? It's got to change. The structure of your brain actually has to change. It's got to make new connections. It's a process of learning. So that's actually pretty scary that you're actually turning your brain over to me to get remodeled and rebuilt. Right, all your instructors do that, or anybody you learn anything from. Okay, so let's look at this thing that can change its shape and rebuild your brain, and it's called a neuron. We see a neuron on the slide on the right. Kind of off my screen a little bit. How is it here? Not too bad. Okay, and it looks like it has a bunch of antennas sticking out of it, and a projection from the main part of something, like the projection coming off of a bone, is called a process, right? For muscle attachment. Well, these projections right here, we call processes as well. And then there's one big long process. These short, highly branched processes are what we call dendrites. And dendrites receive information. Dendrites are relatively short. They receive information and send it down into what we call the cell body or the soma of a neuron. The soma or cell body contains many mitochondria and a lot of different kinds of endoplasmic reticulum and the nucleus and all the organelles that a normal cell should have. Right? And this is the biggest part of the neuron, is the cell body. And these NISCL bodies right here is just rough endoplasmic reticulum that is making all the kinds of proteins that a nerve needs to make, like a neurotransmitter. And it stains a nice color, and so somebody by the name of NISCL sounds like a Denmark person. I don't know, where's NISCL come from? Anybody know? But any Scandinavian name, okay, characterized these things inside of a neuron, and so it was named after him. All right, and then there's one other very long projection. This thing can be, I should actually calculate it, but I'm going to say millions of times longer than a dendrite. Of course, we can't really show that on this illustration because if this axon was drawn to scale and it was a million times longer, where would it end up? Probably like Pasadena someplace, right? So this is a very long structure in your body. It could be a meter or 2 meters long, but these dendrites are going to be on the order of just microns long, like a million times smaller. Okay, so here is an axon. Those are the three parts of an axon. And I also see an arrow on this diagram. Anybody see an arrow on this diagram? Tell me how I should move the cursor to find an arrow. Down. Right. Up. Oh, I passed it by. Right there. There's an arrow. It says impulse direction. What can you tell me about this arrow? Is it bidirectional or unidirectional? Unidirectional. Information flows over a neuron in just one way. It always flows from dendrite to cell body, down an axon, down to the tip of an axon. This tip of an axon has got some special things in it, and we call that an axon terminal. And maybe you can see that they have little swellings right there. Sometimes we call it a terminal button or a Bouton terminale in the terminal or the most distal parts of a neuron. So this is a pretty good example of just your generic neuron. It's got the three basic features. The two receiving ends of the neuron are the dendrites and cell body, and the sending part is the axon that sends information very rapidly over long distances. Okay, so I think we talked about everything. Here's a nice micrograph that shows the cell body, and then surround, and here's some dendrites, here's a really long axon coming down, and I see nuclei of other cells that are surrounding the cell body of a neuron. Those are the support cells, or the neuroglia cells, and since they surround them on the outside, sometimes they're called satellite cells. Satellite is a special kind of support cell that we find in the peripheral nervous system exclusively. Satellite is in the PNS. And then I see some beads wrapping themselves around an axon. This is another kind of support cell. It's not a satellite cell. We call this a Schwann cell. And a Schwann cell is lying down a chemical that's a lipid, and it acts like an insulator. So you could think of an axon as being a wire, and let's just say that you had a toaster at home, and you wanted to unplug this toaster, and let's just say that the wires didn't have any rubber or plastic. The wires were actually sticking out. Would you grab that wire to unplug it from the wall? No, because the electricity would go right from the wire into your body and give you an electrical shock. All right, so the same thing with these Schwann cells. It changes the electrical properties of this axon so that the electricity stays inside the axon and doesn't leak out. And we'll talk about the significance of that in just a little bit. Schwann cells are found in the peripheral nervous system, just like these satellite cells right here. And a satellite cell is just a specific kind of neuroglia cell. Schwann cell. So you should think of the Schwann cell as making insulation around an axon. All right, so several functions characterized by the ability to conduct electrical impulses, and you should know what direction that is. Dendrite, cell body, down an axon. Extremely long-lived. One of these cells will last your whole lifetime. Okay, they do not divide, so if you damage those central nervous system cells, guess what? Then you can't replace them. That's a big issue in medicine today because we would like to be able to replace damaged cells when somebody receives trauma to the spinal cord or to the brain. But currently, we don't know how to do that. And another thing is that they're highly metabolically active. They have a high metabolic rate. They require a lot of a compound to keep them alive. And I think we talked about this compound because it's made by mitochondria. What is that compound? The energy molecule, ATP. So these neurons need a ton of ATP just to stay alive. And to give you an idea, if we were to cut off the supply of oxygen to mitochondria, they would stop making ATP. So if somebody has experiencing a heart attack and their heart stops, how long can they maintain consciousness? Because that consciousness is a result of the function of millions of neurons inside your brain. They will start to lose their function if mitochondria don't produce ATP. So how long do you have consciousness for if your brain stops receiving oxygen and blood? Okay, you know what? It's 3 seconds. So if somebody's heart stops in 3 seconds, they become unconscious, right? They have no, of course, then you pass out. And then after a period of time, if oxygen isn't restored to the brain, those mitochondria will never be able to make ATP again, and the brain is going to die. So in 3 seconds, the brain goes unconscious. When does the brain actually die? And remember, when the brain dies, it can't come back. Death is that irreversible process. So it's really hard to talk about in medicine. We don't like to accept it. But when does a brain die after blood supply is interrupted? And that's where that first one somebody mentioned, 3 minutes. So you don't have very long. 3 seconds, and then a person is unconscious after 3 minutes, for an adult anyway, then the brain is dead. But let's just say we have a student in class all of a sudden passed out, and somebody felt a pulse, noticed their pulse wasn't, their heart wasn't beating. Okay, so what can we do for somebody whose heart is not beating by themselves? Yeah, you can do CPR. A lot of people are certified in CPR. You can do chest compressions that pressurizes the heart, that pumps a little blood. A little blood to the brain is a whole lot better than none whatsoever. So you might extend that period of time from 3 minutes to maybe 15 or 20 minutes or till when the EMTs get here and help hook up some oxygen to the patient or whatever. All right, but you should never stop CPR, all right, even though you've been doing it for 5 or 10 minutes, because you just never know. And if it's me that passes out, keep doing it for like 4 or 5 hours, right? Because you never know. You're going to be really tired after that period of time. That's the way it goes. But I'll give you extra credit if it works. Okay, so neurons receive stimulus. They transmit impulses. The basic unit of an impulse is what we call an action potential. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And an action potential in motion is what we call a nerve impulse. And it goes, a stimulus is picked up by a dendrite, and that information flows into the cell body and then down in axons. All right, let's classify some neurons. I don't think I want to talk about anything else right here. No, we're good. Okay, we got three kinds of neurons. Do I have it on this next slide? Not really. Okay, I'll find it in just a second. Okay, three kinds of neurons that I want you to be able to recognize by the shape. Because if the shape of the neuron changes, guess what else changes? You're going to see that its function changes, right? And we're going to look at some of the functions. So let me go and find the shapes of these things. They kind of switched it around in your book, put it way back at the end of the chapter. Okay. So look at the slide on the right. And we got three different kinds of cells. We got a multipolar cell in column 1. We've got a bipolar cell in column 2. And then we have a unipolar cell in column 3. And I see a cell body in each of these. All right, so here's the cell body in a multipolar neuron. Here's the cell body in a bipolar. Here's the cell body in a unipolar. Sometimes it's called pseudo-unipolar because there are two long processes, but these two long processes come from a single central process right here. Okay, so I do. Oh, and then here's a nice illustration down at the very bottom, too, without some of the labels. All right, so the short processes, especially on a multipolar neuron, this is the receiving end of a neuron. These are what we call dendrites. Then here's the cell body. What's another name for cell body? That's the soma, S-O-M-A, of a neuron. And then here's one long axon, and I can see some Schwann cells wrapped around this axon. This is a structural classification, multipolar. And what a multipolar neuron is used for is that it's used for an efferent pathway. It's an efferent neuron. It's a motor neuron. So write down maybe motor neuron here. Another kind of neuron is association neuron. So this is a kind of neuron that shares information within the central nervous system. That's multipolar. Bipolar, okay, we notice that there's a cell body, and it looks like it has two axons on it. But it's actually one long dendrite before it reaches all these very small projections here. So this is still the receiving end of the neuron, and the axon is the sending end of this neuron. So electrical impulses still always travel from left to right on this illustration. This kind of neuron is what we find in certain sense organs that are very specialized, like in the ear and the eye. Okay, so a bipolar neuron is for sensory reception, but very special kinds of sensory reception and limited locations in the body. This last kind right here sort of looks like a bipolar. We call it pseudo-unipolar. This one is specialized specifically for afferent signals. So this is a sensory neuron. It's never used as a motor neuron. So the first one is a motor neuron. The second one is for special senses. The third one here, or the unipolar, is for sensation. It's a sensory or an afferent neuron. What do we say motor? What's another name for motor? Efferent. Yeah, so you could put efferent. And we use those terms all at the same time. So this is table 12.2 that we were looking at. It's not a figure, 12.2. Okay, let me go back to this list right here. All right, so multipolar, motor and interneurons. Aha, it's in your notes. Bipolar, special senses, for instance, like vision. And a unipolar, that's a sensory neuron. So all information that enters the CNS is from a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar type of neuron. All right, so I do want you to recognize those by shape and also by function. All right, a second type of cell in nervous tissue are what we call support cells or neuroglia cells. These don't transmit electrical information. They do other kinds of things. We'll talk about what they do in a little bit. One kind we talked about was a Schwann cell. And what does a Schwann cell do? It wraps insulation around an axon. That's one of the jobs of a support cell. And a Schwann cell is always located in the peripheral nervous system, never in the central nervous system. All right, so I'm actually talking about this one way down here on your list. That chemical that's a lipid, that's a fat, that acts as insulation is called myelin. So you should know the name of that chemical because you know a bunch of names of chemicals like keratin, collagen, right, elastin. Here's another chemical that you should know. It's called myelin, and it's a lipid that acts as an insulator, and a Schwann cell wraps layers and layers and layers of myelin around an axon to insulate it. Okay, and the satellite cells we saw, they surround the cell bodies of, in particular, right, these pseudo-unipolar neurons that we find in the peripheral nervous system and maintain the health of the cell body of a unipolar type neuron. All right, so those we find, satellite cells and Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system. These other support cells we find in the central nervous system. Let's take a look at the shape of some of those and what their functions might be. So I got to go back to a figure up over here. Pretty close. Okay. I tell you what, before I get to that one, I'll talk about this one. So here's the neuron in this gold color. The support cells are like in this gray color or blue, right? So you see the neuron. And what I would like for you to see is what is the shape of this neuron right here? What kind of neuron is this? It's a single process, then it bifurcates into two long processes right here. This is a pseudo-unipolar, right, or unipolar neuron. And this is in the peripheral nervous system. And so what kind of support cells do we have in the peripheral nervous system? We have Schwann cells that are making this myelin sheath around an axon. And we also have support cells that surround the cell body of the unipolar neuron. And those are what we call the satellite cells. Okay, so here we see satellite cells. A group of these nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is what makes a ganglia up. So if we put thousands of these neurons together, you're going to have a group of 1,000 of these nerve cell bodies. It's kind of a big structure. It forms a bulge and a nerve someplace. And that's what we call a ganglion in the peripheral nervous system. So these cells are strictly peripheral nervous system. All right, so let's look at some cells in the central nervous system. Here is an oligodendrocyte. And an oligodendrocyte is kind of a cousin to a Schwann cell, but it's a little bit different. We can see that it wraps a myelin sheath around an axon. So the gold, again, is an axon. I see three separate axons right here. But I only see one oligodendrocyte. And the job of an oligodendrocyte is exactly the same as a Schwann cell, except an oligodendrocyte is in the central nervous system. The big difference. All right, the other difference is one oligodendrocyte can myelinate numerous axons, but a Schwann cell can only myelinate one axon in that one location. All right, so that's a big difference. Another big difference is that a Schwann cell, let me go back to the previous slide, if this nerve were to be damaged, these Schwann cells will help the nerve regenerate. So it is possible to regenerate innervation to your periphery. For instance, if you got into an accident and you cut a nerve in your hand or your arms and you lost sensation or motor control of your hand, it is possible for that nerve to grow back down into the hand and make connections so that you can gain some function of your hand or sensation in your hand. Okay, because the Schwann cells will promote that regeneration. Oligodendrocytes, on the other hand, all right, inhibit regeneration in the central nervous system. That's another reason why damage to the central nervous system is so damaging, because you can't recover from it because oligodendrocytes prevent regeneration. So in the central nervous system, your tissue is more concerned about cells growing too much or too fast, okay, compared to your peripheral nervous system. So that might seem a little strange, but what were to happen if you were to have some nervous tissue in your brain that all of a sudden started to grow very rapidly? What would that be? And I'll give you a hint. It's not a smart brain. I'd like to think of brains as really smart when they grow and get big and things like that. But if you have a part of the brain that's growing and getting big, what is that? That's a tumor, and it could be cancerous. And so these oligodendrocytes are specifically inside your central nervous system to prevent tumor formation and cancer formation. Okay, and a side effect of that is that it prevents regeneration. That's just a trade-off, okay, until we can figure out how to control it, maybe with pharmaceutical agents or something. All right, so oligodendrocyte, important thing to know, central nervous system, and it's the counterpart to the Schwann cell. Another kind of cell, we call these ependymal cells. Kind of sounds like epidermis a little bit, ependymal cells. These are lining cavities that are inside your brain. So we have a lot of chambers inside of our brain that are filled with a fluid, and probably you're familiar with that fluid. It's called cerebrospinal fluid. And it helps float your brain so that your brain isn't so heavy, because if you were to weigh yourself in a pool and then on dry land, where would you weigh more? Because you partially float, right, in a pool, you would hardly weigh anything if you were to step on a scale. All right, so that's part of the job of this fluid right here. It helps suspend the brain so that the brain doesn't squish itself completely. And that fluid comes from modifications of these ependymal cells. All right, so these ependymal cells secrete cerebrospinal fluid into the cavities of the brain. Oh, it says right here. That's exactly what it does. Cerebro, right, because cerebrum is the part of the brain. Spinal refers to the spinal cord. We can put these two words together by doing what? Putting an O between them, cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so sometimes these cells join with capillaries to make that fluid, that special structure of a capillary and ependymal cells. It's got a name which I'll think about in just a sec. Choroid plexus, it's called a choroid plexus. So ependymal cells help make up a choroid plexus. Okay, another kind of support cell or neuroglia cell is a microglial cell, or a microglial cell. And these are like white blood cells in our blood. They help fight infection. It's part of the immune response. So these cells are in your brain looking for bacteria, actually looking for tumors as well that don't belong in your brain. And then when it bumps into something that doesn't belong there, it develops an immune response to kill those cells to prevent brain infection. So it could be bacteria. Learned of something not too long ago that some people's brains were infected with a fungus. Fungal infections of the brain are pretty rare, but if somebody takes a hypodermic needle and the solution is filled with a fungus and injects it into your spinal cord or brain, then you have this fungus inside your brain, and we call that encephalitis, a fungal encephalitis. So it's the job of this cell right here, right, to protect you from that kind of infection. And that was involved with, I think, some kind of steroid injection somebody was getting. Anybody hear that on the news? A couple thousand cases. Not everybody died, but a couple people died as a result, and they're tracking down all of that medication.
Meningitis.
Meningitis, encephalitis, pretty similar. Yeah, meningitis would be of the meninges. Encephalitis would be of the brain tissue in particular. Okay. All right, so that's a third kind of cell. The fourth kind of cell is this one right here. It's an astrocyte. And I can see a neuron. Okay, it looks like a nice multipolar neuron, though I don't see much of it. Then I see some blood vessels, very small blood vessels. These are capillaries. And this is the astrocyte. It has many projections. And on some of the projections, we can see it wrapping itself around parts of the neuron. And through the same cell, other parts of these projections will attach themselves to this blood vessel. And so the job of an astrocyte is really interesting. We're learning more and more all the time about it. But it can take nutrients, for instance, like glucose from the blood, absorb it, and deliver it directly to this neuron. So it's a nice door-to-door delivery service. And we said that the metabolic activity of a neuron is very high, and it needs a lot of ATP constantly, and it needs glucose in order, mitochondria need glucose to make that ATP. So these astrocytes help maintain the function of these neurons by bringing nutrients to a neuron and also specifically removing waste products to the blood from this neuron so that it can stay healthy. All right, but also, since an astrocyte can wrap itself around a capillary, it will prevent other things that are in the blood from entering the brain. So astrocytes also make something called a blood-brain barrier. that prevents everything that's in your blood from entering your brain. That protects your brain from all kinds of pesticides and other kinds of harmful compounds. And maybe even some potentially beneficial compounds, pharmaceutical agents, can't get through the blood-brain barrier, and so they can't be given intravenously, or they have to be redesigned by the pharmaceutical company that has figured out a way to get that drug through the blood-brain barrier that is made by an astrocyte. So that's the function of some of these different kinds of cells. So glucose transport, involved with the blood-brain barrier, and these are the cells that are active when you're learning as well, because they will secrete compounds that will cause this neuron that is alive and there to grow and put out new processes and make new connections with different parts or different cells inside the brain. So it helps design the architecture of the brain, and as your architecture changes of the brain, we call that brain plasticity. That's part of learning. That makes you smarter, right? So the kind of brain that you have after an anatomy class is not the same kind of brain as you had when you walked in the door the first day, because it's changing. As a result of these astrocytes secreting neurotrophins, do I have that in here? Neurotrophic factor, right, which promotes connections between other neurons. Okay, we talked a little bit about myelin sheaths. I got a couple pictures regarding myelin sheaths. Maybe I can show you. Where did it go? All right, so this is a process that a Schwann cell would do in the peripheral nervous system, that a similar process would happen in the central nervous system, right? What kind of cell would make a myelin sheath in the central nervous system? Oligodendrocyte, so make sure you can recognize that as an oligodendrocyte. But this is a Schwann cell, and here you can see a bunch of cytoplasm of the Schwann cell, and it's just beginning to do its job. Here is a naked axon without a myelin sheath around it. So a Schwann cell migrates over to this axon, pinches itself around, and here is the nucleus of the Schwann cell. And then it starts to produce a lot of myelin that gets wrapped around the axon. And as the cell is wrapping around the axon, notice the cytoplasm is squished out to the end of the cell. Myelin is now trapped on the inside of the cell, and the Schwann will wrap itself numerous times, and so this is what we call the myelin sheath of a Schwann cell that acts as insulation, does not contain cytoplasm. This is the remnants of the cytoplasm within the Schwann cell that contains the nucleus. This part right here sometimes we call the neurolemma. All right, so the neurolemma contains cytoplasm, and then the deeper layers of the Schwann cell contain myelin that act as insulation. So the cytoplasm is not an insulator, but the deeper myelin layers are. All right, so an oligodendrocyte will do the same kind of thing. All right, so those are some... concepts for oligodendrocytes and Schwann cells. All right, so we said that an electrical impulse will move over a neuron in what kind of direction? From a dendrite over the cell body down an axon. Okay, and it can do it in two different ways, depending on whether this axon is myelinated or not myelinated. Let's erase these cells from this axon. What are these cells right here? These are Schwann cells. Let's take all these Schwann cells away so that we just have a gold-colored axon everywhere right here. And if there is a nerve impulse, then it's going to conduct this electricity molecule by molecule by molecule by molecule. And that nerve impulse is going to travel relatively slowly, maybe a couple miles an hour. Okay, from this part that kind of looks like a funnel, this part of a neuron is what we call the axon hillock. Kind of looks like a funnel to me. So that electrical information gets funneled into the axon and it moves relatively slowly to these axon terminals before the information is shared with other cells. Now, what kind of neurons would you like to have? Fast ones or slow ones? We just described a process that's relatively slow. Let's just say you're going to go buy a computer. What's a better computer, a fast one or a slow one? Yeah, fast is better. Same thing for processing information in the brain. Faster is better. All right, so what has been worked out by evolution is to put insulation down around an axon, and now the electrical signal, instead of going molecule by molecule by molecule, actually skips from one end of a Schwann cell to another, and then to another, and then to another, and it can be as fast as 300 miles an hour, which is 100 times faster. Right, so if there's this bus coming right at you, you want to have myelinated axons because you can jump out of the way 100 times faster. Right, so there's a big advantage to having myelination in your peripheral and central nervous system. These gaps between Schwann cells are what we call nodes of Ranvier. And when a nerve impulse hops from one node of Ranvier to another very rapidly, we call that saltatory conduction. All right, so myelinated axons transmit electrical information via saltatory conduction, but non-myelinated axons conduct electrical impulses by what we call continuous conduction. Right, continuous versus saltatory. Where do we have that? So continuous conduction is slow, non-myelinated axons, and then saltatory conduction is when you have a myelinated axon, when a nerve impulse will hop from one node to another. Now, what kind of cells will provide for saltatory conduction? There's two kinds of cells, and you should identify them by location in your body as well. The skipping kind of nerve impulse is due to a Schwann cell. We call that saltatory conduction. Where do you find Schwann cells? Peripheral nervous system, but also in the central nervous system as a result of oligodendrocytes. Okay, so you got to be familiar with those two different kinds of cells, where they're located, but it speeds up the rate of conduction. Another way of thinking of it, let's think of these stairs right here, and let's think about running these stairs. Which way would you like to run these stairs? Would you like to run up, or would you like to run down? I'll run down. Yeah, you guys could run up, but I'll run down. And I'll run down two different ways. We'll just do the experiment in our mind. Okay, two different ways when I'm running down the stairs. I would step on every single stair. That's a rule. Okay, I have to step on every single stair would be the first way. And then the second way, I get to skip stairs. I could do like every three stairs and run down. What would be faster? Yeah, skipping. And in terms of that analogy in the nervous system, when a nerve impulse skips, what kind of conduction do we call that? That's saltatory conduction. That's faster, right? That's beneficial for us. Okay. And that's the result of Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system or oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system. Okay. The next topic is what we call the synapse. Okay. And I like to talk about a synapse in the following sense, is that it is the structural and functional unit of communication between neurons or between two cells in your body. And you're kind of familiar with that because we talked about the structural and functional unit of contraction. What was that? The sarcomere, right? It had a bunch of little components to it, but if you know all those little components and how they work together, then you know how a whole sarcomere works. And if you know one sarcomere, you know how the whole muscle works. So it's a nice functional unit you should have in your mind. What's the structural and functional unit of life? Pretty complicated topic, but if you understand a cell, then you pretty much know how all life works. Right, all the little pieces of a cell. What about the structural and functional unit of compact bone? Osteon, right? It's got a bunch of little components to it, but if you know how all these functions fit together or units fit together, then you know why bone is so strong. All right, so let's think about communication between cells. You need a synapse to do that. And there are two main kinds of synapses. We're going to look at one right here. And this is what we call a chemical synapse. It's going to transmit information between two nerve cells as a chemical signal. So I see two cells on this illustration right here. I see the axon of a proximal neuron coming down from the top of this picture, and it's touching this neuron that's on the bottom, and I can see the structure of this one on the bottom. That's a nice multipolar neuron with numerous short dendrites and one long axon. All right, so I see actually two neurons. And the synapse is the connection between them. The cell that comes before the synapse is what we call the presynaptic neuron. And the membrane surrounding the presynaptic neuron is the presynaptic membrane. The second neuron is what we call the postsynaptic neuron because it comes after the synapse. And it contains a membrane that we call the postsynaptic membrane. So pre is the cell that is sending information, post is the cell receiving information, and that information is going to be carried as a chemical across this junction. So if we zoom into this region right here, if we zoom into this synapse between the pre and postsynaptic cells, it looks like this thing that we see on the right. All right, so the two cells are not touching each other. Right, there's a space between them that we call the synaptic cleft, and it's filled with a fluid, and that fluid prevents electricity from going from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron. It could jump this gap right here, but if it were to jump, then it would be a lightning bolt, and we don't have lightning bolts running around inside our body, right, because that'd be really damaging. So information is transmitted through the presynaptic neuron as an electrical signal. The electrical signal stops right here at the terminus, and then that electrical signal is converted into a chemical signal that moves across the synapse. It diffuses from high concentration to low. That chemical then bumps into the postsynaptic membrane, and it causes the development of the initiation of another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. So through a chemical synapse, information is transmitted as an electrical signal, converted to a chemical, and then converted back to an electrical signal. So think electrical, chemical, electrical. And let's see how that happens. Okay, a nerve impulse will come down in the axon to this Bouton terminale, or sometimes we just call it a terminal swelling or terminal button because it's kind of swollen up. Has a lot of mitochondria, so what does this area of a neuron need? Needs a lot of ATP, right? Needs oxygen and glucose in order to make that ATP. And then I see other organelles that fill up this terminal button, and we call these synaptic vesicles. They're filled with the signaling molecule that is going to cause the initiation of an electrical impulse in the postsynaptic neuron. And they're just sitting there. But when a nerve impulse comes down, there is a compound that enters the terminal button here, and that's called calcium. Calcium ions flood into the terminal button, and when calcium is inside this terminal button, these vesicles move over to the presynaptic membrane, fuse to it, and then exocytose this compound into the synaptic cleft. So the signaling molecule for exocytosis of this signaling compound is calcium as it enters the cell, not the electrical signal directly, but the electrical signal causes calcium to enter the neuron, then causing the release of this signaling compound. That signaling compound is what we call a neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter is just a general term for things that are contained in synaptic vesicles that can trigger or suppress electrical activity in neighboring cells. So the neurotransmitter is released, it moves across the synaptic cleft, and it can affect the postsynaptic cell if the postsynaptic cell has something. It's got to have something. For instance, what do you have to have in order to appreciate light, in order to see light? You need eyes, and in your eyes are receptors, right? So a receptor is something that can receive a stimulus. The neurotransmitter is the stimulus. So there are receptors in the postsynaptic membrane that when it binds a neurotransmitter, it starts another electrical signal. So you have electrical in the presynaptic neuron converted to a chemical within the synaptic cleft, and that's converted into another electrical signal in the postsynaptic neuron. And the important ion involved in this process, what's an important ion that I mentioned? Calcium. Okay, so calcium is necessary in your body for neurons to communicate with each other. That process of communication through a synapse is called synaptic transmission. And calcium is all important. Without calcium, the proper levels of calcium in your brain and other parts of your nervous system, then neurons can't communicate with each other. So without calcium, you can't have a brain that's functioning inside your body. So if you have a choice, right, maybe you're running low on calcium. You have a choice of putting calcium in bones to make bones strong. Everybody likes to have strong bones so that they don't fracture and break, right? Or you have calcium to put in your brain so that you have a functioning brain. Those are your only two choices, right? Put calcium in bones to make them strong, or put calcium in your brain to make your brain function. What would be your choice? Let's see if you have calcium in your brain. You would say, oh, well, I would sacrifice my bones any day so that I can have brain function, because I need brain function to move in order to regulate my heart and to breathe and all of this other activity. And guess what choice your body makes as we get older? The exact same choice. That's why it's never good to run low on calcium and to not exercise when you're young, because we call that osteoporosis, when your bones are demineralized with calcium, so that calcium supports other important functions in your body, even more important functions like, what, synaptic transmission. All right, so not only should you have good calcium in your diet, but there should be something else in your diet, and that is vitamin D, so that you can absorb that calcium from the foods that you eat. Okay, so calcium is all important for synaptic transmission. Let me just look at all of this. Yeah, so I think I talked about all this, and this abbreviation right here, capital C, little a, and then in superscript we have 2 plus right here. That means that it's an ion, it's a positively charged ion, and that Ca stands for calcium. That's just a chemical nomenclature. I don't think I used that on a test. I think on a test I would spell it out, the word calcium, but eventually you'll have to know Ca as being calcium. Okay, I'm not going to talk about depolarization today or repolarization. I'll talk about that next time. All right, so please make sure you sign the sign-in sheet today. That's the end of lecture. And then I'll go set up the practicum for you guys. And I'll turn some lights on. Yeah. You know, I tell you what, can you write me just a quick little note?
Yeah.
With your name,
yep.
And you know, if you know the CRN of your lab section, that would help, because every lab section is different.